Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Seattle author, photographer, and urban naturalist, Kelly Brenner. I was first introduced to Kelly when I read her book, Nature Obscura. It was this past winter, and it was with the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society Book Club. I was completely enchanted with the book and was thrilled when Kelly agreed to come on Nature Now. And I first spoke with Kelly on Nature Now this past May, and even though we were talking via Zoom, we had a great time, and Kelly agreed to record a second show that we'll be hearing just in a minute today. But before I talk with Kelly, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Do you need a hint? I kind of think not. You probably know this one. So on to our conversation with Kelly.
Well, I'm back with Kelly Brenner. We had such a good time talking about two of the critters she discusses in her book, Nature Obscura. The last time we talked about tardigrades and slime molds. Kelly is kind enough to come back and talk about her favorite group of animals, which she says are flies. And I think she means the real flies, as opposed to other kinds of things that might be labeled flies. Kelly, the question's obvious. Why flies? What is it about flies that captures your imagination?
Most people are going to close their eyes and think of a fly and see the common house fly.
Yeah, right. That's what I do.
No, I say that the word common house fly is not correct, because it is one species of fly. And we know right now, at this point in time, that there are over 188 families of flies. And within those 188 families, 160,000 species have been currently identified.
That's a gigantic number.
But that's just the tip of the iceberg, because as with most invertebrates, we know that there are tons and tons we have not yet described. And the current estimate is that there are probably somewhere over 800,000 species of flies in the world.
800,000. That's just huge.
And how do we even comprehend 800,000 flies?
It's sort of mind-boggling, and how 800,000 different flies and different fly niches and ways of being a fly. And
exactly, and that's one of the things I like to highlight, because with 800,000 species about, they have found their little areas everywhere. And one of my favorite is something called a shore fly, and they live on the beach. Now,
there are hardly any insects at all.
Right, exactly. There are lots of invertebrates, but almost no insects. And flies are one of the few that have found ways to live on the beach. And one of those is a barnacle fly. Now, the barnacle fly is very specialized. It feeds only on barnacles. So the larva, they lay the eggs in barnacles. The larva enters the barnacle test, which is that volcano-shaped, structure.
Right, with all the plates that close over it.
Yep, and the larva somehow disables the cirri, which are the feet that sweep out of the barnacle, mm-hmm. and they consume the food. It disables that, and then it eats the barnacle alive. Now, it finishes...
That sounds like a science fiction movie.
It is, just like science fiction. And they do this until they're a pupa, and then they emerge as an adult. But that story, in barnacles, that story is everywhere. There are flies that are associated with, a certain species of animal all over the world. And not only that, but the flies are incredibly important for us, because we are annoyed by the house fly, But other flies, like the syrphid flies or flower flies, hoverflies are also called, are important pollinators. But the problem is that bees get all the attention for pollination services. And so there's not as many studies on flies. But some flies have been studied, and they found that a lot of the same flowers are visited by hoverflies. And there are some species, crop species, that only flies visit. So maybe not the biggest reason, but if you like chocolate, then you have to like flies, because only flies pollinate chocolate.
I had no idea. Wow. Thank you to the chocolate fly.
Right. And then I think there's others like carrots and pepper, like black pepper. But there's such a sheer amount of diversity in flies, and you probably couldn't identify some of the flies as flies. They look like bees. They look like, I don't know, like fluffy teddy bears. I'm thinking of the bee flies. They look like big fluffy teddy bears. But there's such a huge diversity of flies, and they play such an important role all over. There's some that predate only aquatic snails, so you'll only find them around ponds. And there's just so much we still don't know. What I found really interesting when I started researching for Nature Obscura, I was like, flies, well, that'd be easy because, you know, there's tons of flies. But I couldn't find anyone locally who studied flies. I ended up going all the way to Victoria, British Columbia, to find somebody who studied flies.
I sort of had the same reaction. You think, well, flies are common. People must study flies. Do you have a notion of why there aren't more people studying flies?
No, a lot of flies don't impact us in any way. And so most science, most funding comes from, you know, what good is it to us? So flies that...
they're important pollinators, I would...
And that's what we're starting to now recognize, that they are important for pollination services, for waste services, for different other ecosystem services that they provide. But for a long time, nobody's studied flies. And sometimes a certain scientist will study one family, but then they retire or die and nobody takes it up again. So it's just like left drifting. But there's just the sheer number of flies. Yeah, there's just so much room for a naturalist to discover or learn or become a new Miss Lister. Who's the slime mold, expert, who was not an expert, but just had a fascination. Yeah, became one.
So what makes a fly a fly?
So a fly, Diptera is the fly family, and that means two wings. So flies have two wings. Bees and wasps all have four. They have a little stubby remnant of a fly, of a wing. It's called a halter, and it looks like kind of like a drumstick behind their second wing. They also have large eyes relative to bees and wasps, and they often touch in the middle. They have little stubby antenna. Bees almost always have long antenna. And so, that's the gist of a fly.
I think the next time I see a fly, I'll probably pause more and look at it more closely than I might have otherwise. Curious. Which then maybe leads me to a bigger subject of conversation, and that's on being a naturalist and acting as a naturalist. That's looking at flies is triggering my sort of naturalist tendencies to really look at them, because I really never have looked and observed. So just sharing a few thoughts, and then I want to talk more with you, Kelly. The famous E.O. Wilson is an American biologist, naturalist, author of a huge number of books. Some for scientists, but many for the general reader. Wilson says that he approaches the natural world with a childlike sense of wonder. And he goes on to describe in one of his books that naturalists are storytellers who go into the field with open eyes and minds full of curiosity and opportunism. And then another one of Wilson's descriptions about naturalists is someone who is captivated by the tapestry of nature and who searches for patterns discovered directly by observation. I think a lot of these thoughts from Wilson come from his book, just simply called Naturalist. And about a year ago, I interviewed for a Nature Now program one of our local naturalists, Ken Wilson. And Ken makes a statement, and we talked about it a bit in my conversation with him. Ken believes that we are all innately, naturally, neurologically, and genetically wired to be naturalists. So, Kelly, how do you describe being a naturalist?
I want to say first, I agree with that assessment. And the reason why is I am really also interested in folklore and the intersection of nature and folklore. And if you read a lot of old folklore, so many of their beliefs and customs were directly related to nature and recognizing the patterns of weather and what was happening right outside their doorstep in a way we're completely disconnected from today. And I mean, their livelihoods literally depended on their observations of nature. And so I think that inherent naturalist tendency existed, and it's something that we've lost in modern society. Mm. So I think, to me, being a natural, an urban modern naturalist is largely about curiosity and either retaining that sense of wonder or reclaiming it if it's been lost through, I think all children start with that. As Rachel Anderson said, they all have that sense of wonder.
And somehow our education process can obliterate that. And yes, and reclaiming it is a wondrous thing to do.
I think at this point, with the threats of climate change and everything else, I think it's essential that we reclaim it.
Yes.
Because one of the quotes that I like to use is from David Attenborough, who just had his 95th birthday. And he said, basically, we're not going to protect what we don't care about, and we won't care about what we have never experienced. So if we don't experience that connection to a tree or a bug or a bird, then what do we care about protecting it? I mean, even if it's for our own good. Mm-hmm. So I think it's essential that we all try to reclaim that sense of wonder. And plus, it's just fun.
Yeah, that's also true. Like, you know, what's, you know, how much fun can that be? And I also think, and I think your book, Nature Obscura, is a lovely example. I think as a naturalist, you kind of go beyond just looking and seeing and noting. There's an intent to observe and to watch and to ask questions and try to learn. You have a quote in your book, and I love it. It's from Sherlock Holmes, who says, "The world is full of obvious things which nobody by chance observes." I thought, yeah, you know, that's true. There's an intention behind observation and really seeing. Mm-hmm. You use the phrase urban naturalist to talk about you in this modern world. And now we're out here in Port Townsend, and we're not really urban, but we're certainly not wild. And which kind of makes me wonder, I mean, what do you mean by urban naturalist?
I think to be an urban naturalist is just to observe your place, where you are, where you live, mm-hmm. instead of thinking of nature as somewhere, some, you know, generic
outside.
Out there. Yeah, it's not out there, it's here. It's literally up on your rooftop, in your basement, outside your door. So it's not if you live in a city. It's just wherever. I mean, unless you live in some rustic cabin in the woods.
Yeah, but
you're just a naturalist. But I think it has. I think my thinking is more of, you know, knowing the place where you live, knowing your place.
Mm-hmm. Which I have a sense that, you know, as we look at naturalists, you know, through history, they do know their place. You know. And I think David Attenborough, you mentioned him early, his place to me is the entire earth. When you go out of doors to observe and you put yourself in this place of intent and place of wonder, what do you make sure that you take along with you?
Mostly I take along my senses. I like to say that you don't need any tools. You don't need, I mean, you could take binoculars or a hand lens with you, but what I rely on most of anything are my senses. And using my senses to, as you say, not really see, but observe and hear. If I hear crows making a big ruckus, to take the time to look and see why are they making a big ruckus. Not that they just are, but why, which often leads
what's
to
going on.
Yeah. And also recognizing the patterns. Like I know around this time every year, I'm going to start looking for something called the black dancer caddisflies. And they show up around Lake Washington every year in the spring in just swarms, but they're tiny. So they kind of go overlooked and nobody really notices them. But knowing that I just have a sense that this time is coming. So I like to frequent the same places. I have the park where I go for a walk several days a week. I know my backyard intimately. And having just my senses, and it's maybe comes more naturally for me, but if you haven't been practicing your senses, there's lots of ways to do that. There's something called finding a sit spot, and it's somewhere where you just spend 5 minutes to, I mean, an hour, however long you want, as often as you can, whether it's daily or two or three times a week, and you just go and you sit and you like practice mindfulness when you're just present in the moment. And that teaches you to really use your, you know, not just your eyes, but also your ears and you know, feeling the breeze or the just noticing all the little things. And it just kind of helps you tune in your senses.
Yeah, I've tried a little bit with that practice. And I know I'm trying to think, the book is What a Robin Knows, but there's a lot in there about a sit spot and how to tune your senses. And I know you mentioned hearing. One of the things when I was doing that pretty regularly was tuning in to hearing and being able to hear things in the distance that I paid no attention to until I quieted and set and really expanded my senses. And the sense that I feel I have completely underdeveloped is the sense of smell. And you're talking with Sarah Spaeth, who's a naturalist here in town, and she also is a very skilled animal tracker. And she was talking about, you know, putting her nose in the beds where the elk had lain and being able to actually smell the elk and then take that sense with her as she, you know, continued to track and continued to look for them. So I have a feeling there's a whole sense of wonder there that I have that I don't appreciate. So tell me about other senses and smell and I mean, sight's pretty obvious. Hearing and touch is another big one for me. Mm-hmm. And using that sense sort of ethically, since you really can't touch indiscriminately.
Well, yes, yeah, so smell's a fun one because, like, there are some sea sponges that smell like gunmetal.
Oh, yes, there
are. Gunpowder, yes. And there's a nudibranch that smells like watermelon. So, yeah, I like to sniff things. People look at you weird, but you know.
Yeah.
And touch, yeah, touch is important. I always say that one day I'm gonna like become possessed by an alien because I poke everything.
Yeah.
But it's how I tell like a slime mold from a fungi, because fungi tend to be pretty firm, and if I poke it and it's squishy, it's usually a slime mold. So
I go
around. I'm at, of course, I have to wash my hands when I'm done, but I when I'm in the forest or when I'm in the tidal zone, I'm touching and poking everything. I mean, I'm trying not to hurt any animals, of course.
Yeah.
But poking and touching, smelling.
Well, it gives you just such a sense of what's in the world with you. So, and you also mentioned to me that you are writing a new book called How to Be a Naturalist. So tell me just a bit about that.
So it's a new book also with Mountaineers Books, and it is going to consist of about 20 activities, things that you can do to really get a deeper sense of nature that you live with. For example, one of the activities will be how to grow your own slime molds in a moist chamber, And this isn't just a wacky idea. It's actually a scientific method that scientists use. I'm going to have other activities like how to find tardigrades, how to find face mites, because we all have face mites.
Oh, yes, we do. That's kind of an eerie thing, because I know we all have them, but I haven't explored my own face mites.
Some people might not want to, but, you know, we all have them. So it's going to be just a set of activities. Some of them are scientific activities. Some of them are just different naturalist activities. I kind of channeled my inner Gerald Durrell, who was a British naturalist, who wrote a book called The Amateur Naturalist. So I'm kind of taking some pieces from that and my own experiments and some, you know, some wacky experiments that people might not have tried, like how to make a microbial garden.
So are you targeting this to adults or kids or both or
curious minds? All ages, yeah, for any curious individuals. I'd love to target adults because kids, and we already know that have an inherent sense. So I think the adults are the ones that need to reclaim that sense of wonder. But, I mean, this is absolutely, these are all activities you could do as a family, you could do with kids, you could do in schools, you could do in, you know, high schools, college level, at home. This is all, and it's all simple things that you don't, with the exception of a microscope for a couple activities, everything are materials you can easily find at a thrift store or in your recycling bin. So they're all super accessible and easy to do.
Well, Kelly, we've talked away another 20 minutes. This has been really fun. And perhaps you'll come back again.
And Kelly said she'd come back again. So I do want to mention and share with all of you that Kelly Brenner has a website that is great fun. The website is www.metrofieldguide.com. Metrofieldguide.com. There are lots and lots of interesting information on it. And you can learn about the Nudibranch Society, InvertiFest. There's a Twitter game called Street Creatures and a bunch more of fun things. And as I mentioned earlier, the Land Trust, Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society Book Club read Kelly Brenner's Nature Obscura earlier this year. The book club is open to all. So if it appeals to you, you might want to read and come join. Coming up in August, the book club will be reading Pacific Flyway, and it's written by one of Nature Now's favorite guests, Jeff Hammerson. I just got the book, and I've got to share with you, it is beautiful. It's filled with wondrous photographs of birds and landscapes along the Pacific coast, from the Arctic to Tierra del Fuego. If you're interested in the book club and joining a conversation with Jeff, and he will be at the book club meeting to talk about that book, go to the Jefferson Land Trust website and click on the link to the Natural History Society, or just go directly to www.jltnatural.org/book-club. That's jltnatural.org/book-club. Well, yes, I am sure you recognized the sound of the common housefly, Musca domestica. If you have a good look at it, it has two huge, absolutely huge, reddish compound eyes. You can barely see that, but they do have three little simple eyes. And houseflies can process visual information around 7 times more quickly than humans. No wonder they are so challenging to catch or to try to swat. That's it for Nature Now for this week. We do hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Nature Now airs here on KPTZ at 91.9 on Wednesdays and Saturdays at 12:30, and most Thursdays around 5:30 following the news. And do, if you miss those times, check out our podcasts. They're just available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. Of course, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at naturenow@kpt.org. And as KPTZ is planning its big move to a new studio at Fort Worden, that'll be this fall, I think, Nature Now is looking for new team members. A sense of curiosity about the natural world is the only requirement. Just email us at naturenow@kptz.org and we can chat. The ending music today is from the original motion picture soundtrack by Howard Shore for the 1986 horror film, The Fly.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.